It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in Body Week, focusing on lung function and respiratory illnesses that spread in adults and children. And we start with a focus on pediatrics. Join in with your questions on lung and breathing conditions in kids. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Luella Amos is a pediatric pulmonologist with Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. She's an associate professor of pediatrics at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Amos, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, here we are in flu season. If you could set the scene for us, you know, it's been compounded by COVID and RSV. How would you characterize childhood and infant respiratory ailments this season?
We definitely expect a respiratory viral season every year, but this winter has been more challenging just because of the numbers of children that are getting sick and being hospitalized.
What are you seeing?
The beginning of the fall, we started seeing RSV, so respiratory syncytial virus. We were seeing up to, 200 people, 200 children in our ERs, 300 in our urgent cares on a daily basis. And it was getting very difficult to kind of get our patients admitted to the hospital because beds were being filled pretty rapidly.
And then on top of that, you have flu. And of course, there is a concern about pediatric severe flu cases. What causes death from flu in these pediatric cases?
In general, children have relatively immature lungs and very small airways, especially the younger infants, 6 months and younger, under 1 year. So when you have a respiratory virus like influenza, you can cause a lot of inflammation and a lot of swelling in those lower airways. So they can have significant difficulty breathing with a virus that can maybe just cause a really bad cold in an adult.
When is the time the parent should take the child in when what are some signs that it's time to see the doctor?
The doctor. Yes, absolutely. If you're not able to get your child to eat or drink very well just because they're so lethargic and not feeling well, it's definitely time to come in. If they are having significant difficulty breathing, meaning breathing really fast, it looks like they can't catch their breath. By the time lips start turning colors like blue, you probably should be going to the ER or even calling 911. But before then, difficulty eating, drinking, and breathing pretty fast, you should probably be seen.
So you mentioned RSV and cases of RSV that really spiked in the fall, respiratory syncytial virus. Where are we at now, and how does RSV and influenza affect the lungs differently?
They're both obviously respiratory viruses. Seasonality is one thing. So RSV often shows up earlier than influenza. So like October, November for RSV, and it definitely followed that pattern this year. And then influenza sort of has peaked in December. We're continuing to see some cases in January, and it's just the beginning of February, so we're just waiting. But they both can induce inflammation in the small airways of our young children. And, if you can imagine trying to breathe through a very small straw, you will have difficulty breathing and you will not look well.
So, in these non-life-threatening cases of flu or RSV, how do we manage them at home and be able to give some relief to the child?
So number one is if they have fever or discomfort, like from throat pain or you presume throat pain, it's important to control those symptoms. So you can give them something like acetaminophen or ibuprofen, depending on the age of the patient. We usually like to do ibuprofen over age 6 months. But that will help with just making them feel better. Hydration is essential. They need to drink. It's more important to drink than to eat, just because, you know, that's what's going to bring you to the hospital. And the other thing is it can help maybe thin the thick secretions that you can produce with either of these viruses. It's important just to really support them as much as you can at home with, you know, fever control and oral intake of fluids, because the next step would be coming to the clinic or the ER.
And it's complicated with fluids because what if the baby or infant is nursing and they're refusing to nurse? And I mean, that right there is their fluid and their nutrition.
Exactly. And often the nose is clogged,
right? So yes.
to drink with a clogged nose, I mean, try that at home. You're not going to get much in, and they're going to take a lot of breaks. They're going to, you know, be hungry or thirsty, and they can't do anything about it, especially babies who can't tell you what's wrong.
Talking with Dr. Luella Amos about childhood respiratory infections, what viruses are circulating. She's a pediatric pulmonologist with Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Amos, last month the FDA has received an application to approve a protective option against RSV in infants, this drug nirsevimab. What do you know about the drug? It's a mouthful.
Yes, it is. So nirsevimab, I believe is how you say it. Mm-hmm. You can check on YouTube, double check that. but it is a what we call a monoclonal antibody to help babies who cannot produce this antibody just because they don't have a very mature immune system. And the thought is that it can help them, you know, with fighting off RSV during the RSV season. One thing I think is important for people to know is that there is another monoclonal antibody out there called palivizumab. You can say that a couple times. Mm-hmm. But that is, there's a lot of restriction in terms of the use of this because it's, there are only certain patients that can actually get this, this medication. It's given monthly during RSV season. Usually it's premature infants, children with severe congenital heart disease, and other conditions, but it's a very expensive medication, and it's restricted to certain patients.
You know, so far we've been talking about really contagious infections. Is there anything parents can do to try not to spread this around the home and spread it to other siblings?
Yes, that's a really good question. I mean, one of the questions that I ask in clinic is, are there any other, you know, people sick at home when an infant comes in ill? And often it is yes. You know, there's an older child who goes to school, you know, and they're going to catch something there, and then they have an infant at home. There's only so much you can do depending on the age of the child. But as much hand washing as you can do at home, if you're really concerned, especially with a extremely premature infant, like for example, someone born at 25 weeks, you definitely need to take a lot of precaution. Maybe even consider wearing a mask at home, if your older children or, you know, people will be willing to do so. So those are probably reasonable, but we also have to keep in mind that children, you know, young children may not be able to keep their hands off their younger siblings.
Pediatric pulmonologist Luella Amos of Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, fielding your questions on lung conditions, breathing problems, respiratory illnesses, asthma. Call in at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with a Milwaukee-based pediatric pulmonologist exploring lung function, contagious respiratory illnesses, chronic lung conditions in children like asthma. Call in with your questions about breathing issues, 800-642-1234. Dr. Luella Amos stays with us. Dr. Amos, let's turn to asthma. Asthma medication may be taken with an inhaler. Are improvements being made in asthma maintenance and treatment?
Yes, there are. There are some improvements. You know, there are guidelines for asthma management that have been updated every so often. The one thing that sometimes we have patients on are controller medications, meaning inhaled steroids. There are medications that have not only a steroid in it, but also a long-acting albuterol. I'll kind of explain what albuterol is if you don't know. Please. It is a medication that's inhaled that opens up the airway. Let's just say that it opens up these small airways that are maybe constricting during an asthma attack. So people use albuterol when they have an asthma attack just to relieve their symptoms. There are long-acting albuterol kind of medications that can last, you know, 12 hours-ish, and they can be used in combination with an inhaled steroid. So there are definitely medications out there that are a combination of an inhaled steroid and a long-acting albuterol.
What is the biggest trigger for childhood asthma?
A main trigger, especially right now, kind of a segue from last discussion, is respiratory viruses. So RSV, influenza, a virus called rhinovirus is probably one of the most common viruses that causes that common cold, but it also can trigger wheezing in our patients with asthma. Allergies, smoke exposure, anything that shouldn't be inhaled. So, you know, cigarette smoke, vapes, cannabis. So it can be a lot of things that that can trigger an asthma attack.
Are there things that we can change in our life or in our child's life to reduce the risk of an asthma attack?
So if a child has known asthma, the number one thing that we recommend as pulmonologists is to maintain them on, you know, if they need a controller medication, to maintain on that, because that will help them tolerate exposure to things that they have no control over. So allergies, you know, you can't really control what you're going to be exposed to necessarily, especially if it's out in the, you know, in the environment. If you're allergic to dogs or cats, obviously try to avoid that. You know, if parents smoke and that's a trigger, obviously that has to be something that needs to be dealt with. As much as you can, you know, try to hand wash and prevent, you know, viral exposure. But those are the things that we can definitely do in our younger children to keep them well.
A concern as a parent is whether your child can participate in sports as they start to age and that their peers are in different sports programs. What do you tell parents there?
Specifically with asthma, I ask them just to observe and the child, if they're able to tell me if they have any issues with activity. A lot of the times, yeah, activity is a trigger for an asthma attack. But again, if we are able to get them under control, meaning they don't cough with activity, they don't wheeze with activity, or have shortness of breath with activity, then we can say you can continue to participate in sports. Sometimes they do need albuterol before sports, but that is relatively easy to do. You know, take a couple puffs and then go play your sport.
Talking about childhood respiratory issues with Dr. Luella Amos, pediatric pulmonologist with Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Amos, we heard from Larry in Milwaukee called in and says pulse oximeters should be essential part of a person's medicine cabinet. They're cheap and effective. What is your reaction to oximeters as something at home?
Sure. So pulse oximeters can be purchased over the counter. You can get them at Walgreens or Walmart, of course. And usually the ones that are available commercially are clip-ons, you know, so you clip it on your finger. So I think They can be helpful, especially, you know, during the COVID period, when people were worried about their oxygen levels. In children, though, you know, their fingers are very small, and you may not get accurate reading on them, and you might sort of freak out if their saturations aren't normal. So that's one thing. You might be inducing a lot of anxiety when it's not needed necessarily. So that's, and then the other thing is, you know, not to go into the technical details about pulse oximetry, but the fingers need to be warm and there needs to be good perfusion for that to be an accurate reading. So it's a good thing to have if you can interpret the results in a, you know, reasonably, mm-hmm. if I can, you know, kind of say it in that way. Sometimes if you're not worried, if you're worried about the accuracy of the number, I have parents maybe bring their oximeter and we compare it to our medical grade pulse oximetry in the clinic.
I want to turn to gas stoves, gas stove pollution for a moment and what you see there, because we're seeing these studies that it is connecting now to childhood asthma. Should we be concerned about gas stoves pollution and asthma?
That's another great question. Because again, we're kind of limited with what we can do in our homes, right? What you can control at this point. It's very hard to say. You know, I don't have an answer for you right now. It's kind of a question that we'll probably be able to answer in maybe 5 to 10 years. Because there are a lot of reasons why I think children have asthma, or more children have asthma and allergies nowadays. But, you know, I think, again, it's kind of, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to say, I'm not sure what to say yet about that. It seems to be, you know, similar to how I answered COVID questions a couple of years ago, but, you know, I think we're going to find out. And right now you can only live with your gas stove as much, you got to cook for your kids. So just hold tight.
I want to turn back, as you mentioned, COVID, you know, early on in the pandemic, there were concerns that face masks were restricting airflow, which is not true. But how do you communicate that with patients about wearing masks and their availability to breathe?
You know, it's kind of helpful to, you know, in clinic, because I am wearing a mask. And honestly, maybe I have a skewed view in my clinic just because there are a lot of people sick. So the last thing they want to do is get it. So they are wearing masks pretty compliant. You know, they're pretty adherent to using a mask in clinic. But, you know, just to kind of, I don't know how to, you know, with children, it's going to be hard to get them to wear a mask. With parents, it's really kind of the only way you can maybe prevent transmission of a respiratory virus, especially if you have one and you're trying not to get your child sick. You will not restrict airflow. You will just restrict droplets from getting into the open.
What is the most important thing that a parent can do for a child in their day to keep their child's lungs healthy?
Oh, wow. It's a very, very hard question to answer. You know, in terms of, you know, I think the most important thing, you know, maybe a take-home message from today is to protect the lungs. And what you can do is prevent what you can prevent. So exposure to certain triggers, like smoke exposure, that's one thing you can definitely do. Encourage your teenager to not engage in cigarette smoking, in marijuana smoking, in e-cigarette use, just because there's really nothing they're going to get out of it other than harmed lungs. I think it's important to keep in mind that there are people out there with severe lung disease, and they would definitely wish that they had the lungs of our healthy children. We just have to protect their lungs and breathe easy.
How can parents talk to their kids about the risks of vaping?
You know, I think it's one of those things that we definitely are working together with educators. We definitely have, we have resources actually at Children's Wisconsin on our website to help have that conversation. I think it's important to let them know that nothing other than air should be in the lungs. And if you put anything other than air in there, the lungs will not like it. And not being able to breathe is probably one of the worst things you can experience.
Dr. Amos, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me and your interest in this subject.
Dr. Luella Amos is a pediatric pulmonologist with Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, associate professor of pediatrics at Medical College of Wisconsin. And for disclosure, Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of WPR. Call in with your questions about lungs. Share what respiratory ailments you struggle with. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are in Body Week here, learning about problems with the lungs that prevent them from working properly. Call in with your questions about respiratory diseases or lung infections, worrisome issues with breathing. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. William Ehlenbach is Associate Medical Director for Pulmonology and Sleep Medicine at SSM Health, Dean Medical Group. Dr. Ehlenbach, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. I'm very happy to be here with you.
Good morning. We've been talking about influenza and the role it has in pediatric patients, and it can also be very life-threatening and dangerous for older people. Can you explain why the flu is dangerous for older adults and what you're seeing?
Yes, I mean, the flu is particularly dangerous for older adults. And really, the reason for that is that our immune system changes as we age. So very young babies have a very immature immune system and are at high risk of infections. The immune system develops, you know, during those early years of life, but it starts to become less effective as we reach older ages. And certainly into the sixth, seventh, eighth decade of life, the immune response is not as effective, and that really is why we see significantly increased risk of infections as we age, and including viral infections like influenza. And so most influenza deaths that occur in the U.S. every year are actually in older adults because of that change in immune function as we age.
How does the flu affect lung tissue in adults?
Yeah, so, you know, most cases of influenza can be relatively mild, but there is the risk that influenza can cause pneumonia, so it can cause a direct infection in the lungs, and sometimes that becomes quite severe. So influenza pneumonia can trigger what is called the acute respiratory distress syndrome, which is a life-threatening syndrome of lung inflammation that severely inhibits the lungs' ability to get oxygen into the blood and can make it very hard to breathe. It can make the lungs quite stiff. Patients with, you know, severe influenza pneumonia often need to be cared for in an intensive care unit, and many times it can cause respiratory failure requiring intubation and mechanical ventilation.
It's very serious. I want to turn now to long COVID and the respiratory impact of long COVID. Dr. Ryan Westergaard is chief medical officer at State Health Department, and he recently talked about the symptoms of long COVID during an agency briefing.
Difficulty breathing, muscle and joint pain, brain fog, and chronic fatigue. We're still learning what causes the symptoms of long COVID and how it might affect someone's future lifestyle, health, and wellness.
What is known about the long-term effects of COVID on people's lungs?
Yeah, we have obviously learned quite a bit over these past almost 3 years, but we still have a lot to learn. We do know that people that have persistent symptoms lasting, you know, months after their COVID infection has resolved, many of those people have respiratory symptoms. Shortness of breath is among the most common symptoms of long COVID. And we also know that some people who had COVID infection, particularly those that had more severe COVID pneumonia, do end up with chronic damage to the lungs. And certainly these, you know, there are people that I've seen both in the hospital and in clinic who have really significant chronic lung disease that developed or arose because of their COVID infection. So some of those people have fibrosis or scarring in the lungs that can reduce the volume of the lungs, that can impair the lungs' ability to get oxygen into the blood. And so certainly that's not the majority of people with long COVID symptoms, but there are a subset of those patients who do have really new chronic lung disease because of their COVID infection.
How do you treat or heal or repair lung damage like that?
Yeah, unfortunately, scarring in the lungs or fibrosis is a condition for which we really have very little effective therapy. Oftentimes, when there is damage to the lungs, the body is trying to repair that damage, but sometimes that repair mechanism ends up laying down scar or fibrosis, and we really don't have effective ways of reversing or removing scar once it has developed in the lung. We do have some medications that are used in some scarring conditions that can slow the progression. And that really, those have not been studied much in people with fibrosis because of COVID infection. So unfortunately, that particular condition is one where we're largely focusing on, you know, rehabilitation, improving strength, improving stamina, and trying to help make the rest of the body as efficient as it can be to help deal with the fact that the lungs are now damaged or impaired.
We're discussing lung function, respiratory issues with Dr. William Ehlenbach, who is with SSM Health, Dean Medical Group. You can join in with your questions about the lungs, what issues you've encountered, long COVID, or other types of infections that you've battled and had some lung damage. 800-642-1234. Dr. Ehlenbach, I want to turn to asthma. Adults with asthma significantly more likely to develop post-COVID symptoms compared to adults without asthma. That's according to a recent study in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. Why are adults with asthma affected differently?
Well, you know, asthma is a chronic condition of airways inflammation and bronchial hyperresponsiveness or bronchospasm. And we know that many viral infections can be potent triggers to make asthma inflammation worse. Mm-hmm. And we definitely have seen in clinical practice what the studies are now demonstrating, which is that people with asthma who develop COVID really are at significant risk of worsened asthma control that can last months or even longer. And it really seems to be that viral infection can really trigger a change in immune function and trigger worsened asthma inflammation that leads to the worsened symptoms of asthma, which often, you know, shortness of breath, cough, and wheezing. So asthma control is frequently worse after COVID infection.
COVID aside, the trajectory of asthma, say you have childhood onset of asthma, what might that be like as an adult? I mean, you wonder if you might grow out of it as an adult, or is it with you for life?
Yeah, that's a good question. We know that the severity of asthma often improves substantially as we go through adolescence. But asthma is a chronic condition, and so we really don't believe that people truly grow out of asthma. I, in my clinical practice, often see people who had significant childhood asthma whose symptoms really did improve in their teens or their 20s, but might have a return of symptoms with the right viral trigger or the right allergen exposure. And so it is true that's, you know, asthma severity, asthma symptoms often improve in many people with childhood asthma, but we do consider it to be a chronic condition and one that people probably truly don't outgrow.
Are there any, cures on the horizon for asthma, or is it just improved maintenance treatments for asthma?
Yeah, that's a great question. We really don't, you know, I don't think we're on the verge of cures. There's certainly, you know, really important ongoing research about why some individuals develop asthma in childhood. You know, there may be, we certainly know that parents, smoking in the home is a risk for the development of childhood asthma, so there are some modifiable risk factors. But it also might be just the right viral infection at the right time can trigger the development of asthma. Certainly, we have had substantial improvement in asthma treatments, and over the last 15 years or so have had the emergence of some really exciting therapies that really specifically target some of the aspects of asthma biology. Some of these are injectable medications that are really important for individuals with severe asthma and have dramatically improved asthma control in some of those patients.
Have inhalers changed, or are they still a technology that has been pretty consistent in the treatment for asthma?
Yeah, inhaler technology itself, hasn't changed much. Mm-hmm. The number of medications that are available have increased. Inhaled steroids are really the mainstay of treatment of asthma. And there certainly are more different varieties of inhaled steroids than there were 20 years ago. The inhaler technology did need to change once CFCs were taken out, so propellants that used to be in inhalers that unfortunately affected the ozone layer. That really actually drove some of the innovation and change in the delivery devices and the exact type of inhalers that are used. And because of that, there is a little bit more variety of delivery devices today than there were, 15 or 20 years ago.
Dr. William Ehlenbach, pulmonary disease specialist with SSM Health, Dean Medical Group, calling with your questions about lung disease treatments, disease outcomes, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about lung problems, the symptoms, the risk factors, treatment in the future. Still time to talk about respiratory conditions that are on your mind. Join in by calling with your questions, your comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Dr. William Ehlenbach, who is a pulmonary and critical care specialist in Madison, who stays with us. Dr. Ehlenbach, more than 25 million Americans have sleep apnea, and that's according to the National Sleep Apnea Association. Can sleep apnea cause lung issues?
Yeah, it's interesting. We have learned from relatively recent research that there does seem to be a connection between asthma and obstructive sleep apnea. And in particular, it seems that people with asthma may be more likely to develop sleep apnea. And it seems that the control of asthma is often worse in people who have obstructive sleep apnea.
Hmm. Let's take a call now. Jean in Spring Green. Jean, hi.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm on medication that's called Advair. Everybody knows. Anybody with asthma knows. And it's in the form of a disc that you click and trigger and then inhale. Okay. Expensive, like over $300 a month, and I'm wondering if there's a generic pill that you can take, just with water, because before this disc came out, there had to be a pill, what I mean? A lot less than $300
a month. Less than $300 a month. Gene, thank you. What are the alternatives, Dr. Ehlenbach?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really important question, and one of the real problems of asthma treatment in particular is the cost of inhaled medications. So Advair is a medication that contains, or is an inhaler that contains two medications, an inhaled steroid and a long-acting bronchodilator. The benefit of inhaled steroids compared to steroid pills is that the dose that is needed to help control the respiratory symptoms is much, much lower with an inhaler than it is with a steroid pill like prednisone. And so the side effects, the whole body side effects of steroids end up being much, much higher when pills are used compared to when we use inhaled steroids. Advair is a particular inhaler for which there are now a couple of generic versions. One of them is called Wixela, Wixela. One of them is called AirDuo, AirDuo. And for many patients who are paying significant out-of-pocket for Advair, for many patients, it may actually be cheaper for them to investigate one of the generic alternatives. But the cost of inhalers is really a very significant problem. That's a financial toxicity that our patients bear.
Gene, hope that helps. Thank you so much for the call. Let's go a little bit deeper here on sleep apnea. What are warning signs of sleep apnea?
Yeah, one of the challenges, you know, with sleep apnea is that there are millions of people who have it who really don't know that they have it. Really, everybody with obstructive sleep apnea snores, but not everyone who snores has obstructive sleep apnea. Sleep apnea, probably half of people who snore have obstructive sleep apnea, and of course, many of those folks are undiagnosed. Other common symptoms of sleep apnea would be daytime sleepiness, not feeling well refreshed upon waking up in the morning. You know, some people with sleep apnea even find themselves falling asleep when they don't intend to during the day. And the most dangerous situation is people who have so much excessive daytime sleepiness that they fall asleep while driving or fall asleep on the job. Obviously, that can be quite dangerous. But many people with obstructive sleep apnea don't recognize that sleepiness, particularly if that's just what they've been experiencing for years and years, and it may just feel normal to them. The other thing that often is an indicator of sleep apnea is if someone has a bed partner and that bed partner, you know, not only notices them snoring loudly, but even at times seeming to breathe less or even stop breathing. So those observed pauses in breathing is something that, you know, anyone whose bed partner spouse tells them that really needs to go talk to their doctor about being evaluated for obstructive sleep apnea.
In that evaluation, do you have to do like a night sleep study hooked up in a lab to get a diagnosis?
Yeah, so in-lab sleep studies used to be the only way to reliably diagnose obstructive sleep apnea. There have been, over the past 15 years, you know, technology has improved, and a really significant proportion of people can be evaluated for obstructive sleep apnea with a home sleep study. A home sleep study doesn't monitor all of the different parameters that an in-lab sleep study does, but for many patients, for sort of carefully selected patients, a home sleep study is quite effective. And really that involves, you know, being referred to a sleep medicine doctor, and often that home sleep study would involve picking up a kit. You receive some instruction on how to set it up and how to wear it at night, and then you drop the kit off in many cases the next day. There are even some emerging technologies where the sleep study can be done at home with a device that doesn't even need to be returned. So this is one exciting area where I think the technology is improving. And it's important because it reduces the barrier to people getting evaluated for sleep apnea, which is so important.
What about the technology in CPAPs, continuous positive airway pressure machines? What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, CPAP is the most effective treatment for obstructive sleep apnea. And over the, you know, recent years, the devices have become smaller, and more importantly, they have become quieter. And there have been, you know, features that improve the comfort, makes it a little bit easier to get used to and tolerate wearing CPAP. It is not something that feels natural when patients first start using CPAP, but the vast majority of people are really able to get used to it and really receive substantial benefit from using it. The other improvement in technology has just been mask comfort and the variety of masks that are available. So if you look at the kind of masks, you know, sometimes many people are able to use a mask that just fits around the nose or has some very soft silicone, what we call nasal pillows, that fit into the nose. Some people are best served with a mask that fits around the nose and mouth. But the variety, the size, the feel of the material, it has improved and it continues to improve.
Will you have to use a CPAP forever?
Well, one of the most important risk factors for obstructive sleep apnea is excess weight. And people that are able to achieve weight loss often see improvement and in some cases resolution of obstructive sleep apnea. But for most people, you know, sleep apnea is a chronic condition and a condition that will be with them for the rest of their life.
Talking with Dr. William Ehlenbach on lung issues, adult respiratory issues, you can call in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Talking about occupational respiratory disease, you know, lung conditions people develop through their work. It could be contaminated air with dust, gas, you know, vapor, other toxic materials. Are there some common sources in the workplace for harmful exposure that people should be aware of?
You know, certainly asbestos remains one of the most important exposures. Of course, asbestos is used much less often now than it was decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so most people who are developing asbestos-related lung disease had exposure, you know, decades ago. So thankfully, that's less common. People do still need to be aware that asbestos is frequently used in insulation in older buildings around pipes. It was used in tiles. It was used in other things. And so people doing construction, people doing remodeling, and certainly plumbers, pipe fitters, steam fitters certainly still need to be aware of asbestos and the risks of asbestos. And the risk is really when asbestos dust is inhaled. But as you mentioned, there are many other potential workplace exposures that can lead to lung disease. Biodusts, so dusts that contain organic materials that farmers are often exposed to, bakers, many different occupations, even cheesemakers, which is certainly relevant here in Wisconsin.
Hmm.
There is some risk for lung disease, and in particular, disease called hypersensitivity pneumonitis, from many of these biodust exposures. And then individuals who work in metal plating, metal coating, metal grinding, so often the manufacture and manipulation of metals, are at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And then silicosis is a disease that really comes from breathing in crystalline silica dust. And this is an exposure that people can have in sandblasting, but also in mining, in foundries, and even in construction, and even in kitchen remodeling. So individuals who are cutting granite for countertops, you know, really should be wearing a personal protective equipment and with appropriate masks to reduce the risk of breathing in this silica dust.
Certainly keeping the lungs front of mind and protecting them, you know, as if anything is possible, just to keep protecting them through some types of means. Dr. Ehlenbach, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Dr. William Ehlenbach is Associate Medical Director for Pulmonology and Sleep Medicine at SSM Health Dean Medical Group. And earlier, we talked with pediatric pulmonologist Luella Amos. Keep up with Body Week. Check in on what body symptoms you might have missed, what systems you might have missed. You can listen back to the series in its entirety at WPR.org/mornings. And while you're at it, tell us about health topics you want covered. Email ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.